It's becoming one of the defining public health crises of the century. Loneliness.
The British Prime Minister appointed a Minister of Loneliness today. The new role will tackle solitude in the UK, where more than 1 in 10 people feel isolated.
Government studies have found that more than 9 million people in the UK often or always feel lonely. About half of those over the age of 75 live alone, and more than 200,000 Britons haven't spoken with a friend or relative in over a month. One study even found that loneliness can hurt your health, increasing mortality the same as smoking 15 cigarettes a day.
And this problem isn't just affecting the UK. Debates about how to tackle the loneliness epidemic are happening in Canada and the United States. Now, one distinguished University of Chicago professor is researching how loneliness fits into our understanding of social health and how a more comprehensive view of social well-being could address this issue.
I work on a project that's on the ways that the social world is connected to what I call other dimensions of health.
Linda Waite is one of the world's leading experts on social well-being. Based on the data she's collected from a national survey of elderly Americans, one of the largest groups affected by social health issues, Waite is arguing that our healthcare system needs a revolutionary change around how social health is incorporated into our overall health portfolio. It turns out that having lunch with your friends may be just as important in keeping you alive as exercising.
My dream would be that people would have healthier, more satisfying lives if they and we as a society paid more attention to the social and how it connects to everything else. We could help people the same way we provide physical therapy if somebody has an injury. If we could help people who are lonely develop some skills to join a club, help with people who have some kind of, everybody's body falls apart as they get older, they fall apart in different ways, they have to figure out how to manage sex. So anything, you know, that could be done to help them, encourage them, help them, provide whatever would be all to the good.
From the University of Chicago, this is Big Brains, a podcast about the stories behind the pivotal research and pioneering breakthroughs that are reshaping our world. On this episode, Linda Waite and our social health crisis. I'm your host, Paul Rand. To find out how social well-being should be incorporated into our overall understanding of health, it's important to really understand what it means to be healthy.
Oh, absolutely. I think that that's the core of the project.
Okay.
If what you're doing is saying what sorts of things influence health, then you have to define health. What we did was to start with the World Health Organization definition. In 1947, the World Health Organization said that health is not merely the absence of disease, it's the presence of social, physical, and psychological well-being. But nobody really had taken that seriously, to think seriously about it and to measure it. And so we took it on ourselves to especially do the social. Let me start by saying not everybody in the world would agree with me on this.
Okay.
I'm sort of out there a bit, but I'm committed and I'm pushing.
Okay.
Social well-being would be having good social relationships, being in a good social environment. So the same way you can think of physical well-being as being good cardiovascular functioning, good immune functioning, the absence of cancer. You can think of social functioning as having a number of different components. In the study, the National Social Life Health and Aging Project, which we call NSHAP, looked at the various components, dimensions of social well-being, and we either developed measures or we took measures from other studies, but where there'd been a little bit here or a little bit there, and we put it all together. We developed a measure of social networks that was really extremely cutting edge.
Waite's work over the last few years on the National Social Life, Health, and Aging Project has broken ground on collecting data that revolutionizes our understanding of the importance of social health. Until the project, there had been almost no real scientific attempt to measure population health while taking social well-being into account. And she says that even though the project focused on the elderly, a lot of what they learn can be applied to any age demographic.
We've seen that having friends, having social support is important at any age. If you feel like there's somebody you could count on should you need help, then it helps you deal with stress and, in fact, just reduces your stress. Stress is feeling like you don't have the resources to meet a challenge. And if you feel like you have more social resources, it's sort of like money in the bank. Mm-hmm. So if you have a little savings account, then you don't worry about that. If you have social, you don't worry about that. And you have to think about it the same way.
So what did the InShap project find?
So the project, it has as its heart a nationally representative survey of about 3,000 adults, community dwelling older adults, who were ages 57 to 85 when we first contacted them. We sent a field interviewer, highly trained professional, to their home. She started with this series of questions on social networks. So tell me about your friends. We allow them to list up to five people. The person we're talking to we call ego,
okay,
in this network speak, how they're associated. So I might say, oh, my father and my brother Brad and my friend Chava and my colleague Kate. And then we find out how each of those people is connected to ego, how often they talk, whether they live together, whether they speak about health, the quality of their relationship. But then we find out how dad is connected to each of the other people. How are they associated? Do they know each other? Do they speak? How often do they speak? Generally, a larger network, better connected, with good relationships among the people and diverse kinds of people is
a good first
on
step.
Average better. Social participation.
What does that mean?
Social participation means you do stuff with other people. We ask, how often do you go to church or religious services? How often do you attend the meetings of organized groups like a book club or an exercise group or a bowling league? Or how often do you get together with friends and neighbors? So people who don't participate socially at all in any of these things, we would say are socially isolated. We also measure social support,
okay,
which is extremely important. It's, do you have the feeling, the assurance, the perception that if you needed help, there would be places to get it? We also ask about the marriage or partnership. We ask how happy they are with their marriage. We ask about sexuality in the relationship. We ask a lot about that. We also ask about masturbation. We ask about sexual satisfaction. How emotionally satisfied are you? So we find out about their primary relationship.
The data from Waite's study is publicly available, and researchers from all over the country are using it to delve deeper into how the ways we socialize can affect our overall health.
With a colleague at Michigan State, we looked at the link between marital quality in older adults and the development of risk factors for cardiovascular disease.
Okay.
Incident hypertension, a new stroke, a new diagnosis of heart disease. And what we found was it mattered for women, it didn't matter for men. So poor marital quality put women at risk of developing heart disease.
But not for men.
Not for men.
Okay.
And we have a lot of hypotheses.
I bet you do.
So and based on other people's work, uh-huh, we know that women are more physiologically reactive to stress. There's a researcher at Ohio State, Janice Kecolt Glazer, who's done really foundational work in this area. She brings couples into a lab. She puts an indwelling catheter in them, monitoring for galvanic skin response and so on, and then has them talk about something that they don't agree about. And women are more physiologically reactive to the relationship tension than men are.
One factor in social health that can go overlooked is how our senses either help us or keep us from having a good social life. If I can't see, hear, or touch you, it's hard to make a connection. And if social well-being can be an indicator of physical health, then could studying someone's senses tell you whether they're at risk of dying?
Let me tell you about one of the things that the team found that nobody ever expected. One of the people on the team is Martha McClintock, who's emerita here. She is the smell queen. She really did foundational work on pheromones.
Okay.
So she beat us up until we agreed to include olfactory assessment in this study. And Martha showed that people who couldn't recognize any common household smells, we gave them four, were 35% more likely to die in the next 5 years than people like them with the normal sense of smell. This is a screener that can be used clinically.
Check somebody's, one of these four. And
yes, check somebody's sense of smell, and it would tell you who's at risk that you might need to look more closely.
Okay.
So that was huge.
Absolutely.
It turns out that poor olfaction is also connected to incident Alzheimer's disease. Nobody knew about this.
So anybody listening right now is going to be whiffing things to see if they can smell them.
Whiffing things. And I actually wrote Martha when I heard about this and said, are there any smell exercises? And they said, absolutely, and sent me a link. Have you done it? No, but I do try and
improve your smell.
Or recognize, make it more conscious.
When Waite and her team incorporated the data about social health into the overall health of the population studied, they found something surprising. Many individuals who would be categorized as being in robust health by normal medical standards were shown to actually be vulnerable to all sorts of complications. Normal medical standards focus on the absence of disease, but the social health data revealed issues that were under the surface. Issues that could lead to death or incapacitation within 5 years. At the same time, people with chronic diseases who normally would be labeled unhealthy were actually shown to be quite healthy and not at risk when social well-being was factored in. The implications of the study could have a dramatic effect on how our medical system should think about health. That's coming up after the break.
Capitalism is the engine of prosperity.
Actually, it sows the seeds of its own demise.
Could both be right? I'm Kate Waldock from Georgetown University.
And I'm Luigi Zingales from the University of Chicago.
We're the hosts of Capital Isn't, a podcast about what's working in capitalism today.
And most importantly, what isn't.
We're going to share the sort of irreverent banter you'd hear between economists at a bar.
That is, if economists were to go to a bar.
Subscribe to Capital Isn't. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts.
The implications of Waite's research point to a future in which it's just as important for doctors to ask about how often you're spending time with your friends and connecting with your family as it is for them to ask if you're sleeping well or in any pain. If social well-being has this much effect on us, shouldn't the medical establishment be incorporating it into every aspect of their work?
I'm working on a book with William Dale, who used to be head of geriatric medicine here and moved to City of Hope. We're making the argument that there are things that the medical system focuses on that they overdiagnose,
mm-hmm.
and there are things that they underdiagnose. Here they are, and here's why, and that we ought to be thinking about health more holistically, including the social component. Now that we know that this stuff is going on, people are starting, or communities or organizations are starting to develop interventions. So if somebody's socially isolated, what can you do about that? If somebody's lonely, what can you do about that? Doctors, geriatricians, and I'm still working on this with William, could talk to their older patients about their sex lives. Encouraging people, like you encourage them to eat a nutritious diet, encouraging them to work on their relationship, maybe giving them some tools if you're making sure you get blueberries and bran flakes. Focus on your social relationships too. Assess them and then maybe put in a little effort. It doesn't have to be a lot. You know, most people have siblings. They might have cousins or nieces and nephews. You know, you can make an effort to increase contact and relationship quality. Do something nice. Send a birthday card. You know, take your brother out for lunch or a beer. Just make it a higher priority.
So those are things that, as your work goes along, that ability to have healthcare professionals asking about those questions, having recommendations on those areas, is as important in your mind as it is covering the physical areas. And if there's anything getting in the way of that happening, what is it?
It's the physicians don't want to say to this 89-year-old man, how's your sex life? And often what I hear is that the person will say, I don't want to talk about that. So it's not a conversation that either party is
wanting to have.
Well, or comfortable with. Maybe you just have to open the door and, you know, probably people weren't so comfortable with lots of other things that
right.
they take for granted now.
But there's a lot of other areas you mentioned that may not get into how's their sex life. But
right.
How are they interacting
right,
with others?
Right. How often are you getting out to, you know, to church? Or are you going bowling? Are you doing any volunteer work? You know, that might be a...
And so is that now that the studies are showing the importance of what it is that you're articulating, are there efforts in place or is there pushback about taking time? Because it's not uncommon to go to a doctor's office and to not feel as if you're getting a great deal of attention. You are there to deal with the immediacy of the issue that you have and then shuttled out the door. This would add to it
right.
in a not unsubstantial way. Is that part of the question?
It could be a prescription, right? I'm going to refer you to our social worker.
I see.
She's right over here. You can see her for 15 minutes now and make an appointment.
Uh-huh.
And she'll, you know, help connect you to services and figure out how we can do better on this to make sure you have the support. But there's been a lot of work recently on a related but very distinct concept, which is loneliness, which is the feeling that you're alone. You could be surrounded by a lot of people, but feel like you have nobody to talk to, that you don't fit in, that nobody likes you. Loneliness is a big problem for older adults because they lose people. It's part of getting older. If
right.
you're still alive, the chances are higher that some of the people you love are not.
Right.
And it gets harder to get out. And get around. So it may be that you have people, you just can't get to them as often as you could. So that's a big problem and something where there are people thinking about it and what we could be doing. The military's doing some interventions for returning troops, trying some out on loneliness. Social participation. We could make that easier. There's a really wonderful set of studies led by Linda Freed, who is at Columbia now. She's a physician, and she developed a volunteer program for older adults. They recruited older adults in poor neighborhoods to be volunteers in kindergarten and first grade classrooms in poor areas of Baltimore. They assessed the kids and the older adults, and everybody did better. The older adults had better physical function. They had better mental health. The kids had fewer disciplinary action. There's a whole huge literature on it. AARP, I think, has taken this over. So we could do more of this, right? It's hard for older adults to find volunteer opportunities and then to actually get the training, to have somebody who walks them through it. But we could do more of this as a society.
As Wade is working to get the medical establishment to incorporate her research into how doctors take care of patients, she's already planning her next massive study. That's after the break. If you're listening to Big Brains, there's a good chance you consider yourself a lifelong learner. However, you may not know about the University of Chicago's Graham School and its focus on continuing liberal and professional studies. For more than a century, Graham has been a destination for lifelong learners. They offer courses online and in the classroom, bringing the transformative education UChicago is known for to students of all ages. To learn more about the courses, certificates, and degrees, visit graham.uchicago.edu. No matter how much data that researchers collect, they're always hungry for more. Waite's team is already planning what its next project is going to investigate.
A group of us are thinking about the next study. We're planning a study like NCHAP of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and trans older adult community. This is different because it's a very hard community to sample. If you want to say we've got a nationally representative sample, it's a lot easier with the
general population.
General population than it is with this population. So we're thinking about how to do that. And then what we want to do is basically the same study and then all the things that are specific to this population.
And are there things that, do you have a hypothesis of what you'll be finding different?
Well, here's what we know we have to look at.
Okay.
The National Institutes of Health is very interested in the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and trans community because there are well-documented health disparities. This population tends to have worse mental and physical health and worse health behaviors than they should have given their education and age and so on.
I see.
The question is, what's going on? There are a lot of possibilities. Discrimination, stress. I'm very interested in what happens, especially to older, say, lesbian older adults who are now in their 70s. Did they ever come out to their families? What happened when they did? Because what we hear in just little bits and pieces is that rejection by the family really is the source of many of the disadvantages.
Right.
You know, cutting off from, you're disinherited, you have to move out. If you lose the resources of your parents in that generation, then you're disadvantaged no matter. So that's a possibility. Also, healthcare, finding healthcare, and that's especially a problem for the trans community. So these are all things that we want to look into.
Big Brains is a production of the UChicago Podcast Network. If you like what you heard, please give us a review and a rating. Our show is hosted by Paul M. Rand and produced by me, Matt Hodapp. Thanks for listening.